and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, and this is The Who. And welcome to Radio Free Thinker on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your freethinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher.
And this is Rob, the cognitive psychologist and recently returned traveler.
Right. Well, we have a great show for you today. We, in fact, have a very special show. This will be our first hour-long episode of Radio Free Thinker.
You can test episode for twice as long.
Excellent. Well, so Rob, you just mentioned you got back. Where did you get back from?
So I went on a whirlwind tour of the West Coast, kind of. I was in a conference in Portland, then I went to San Diego for the Comic Con, and then I went up and spent some time in the Central Valley near Sacramento in a place called Davis.
So what is this Comic Con thing?
Is it a communist type thing where a bunch of commies
go? No, it's not Comic Con, it's Comic Con. Oh. Although it has a lot more than just comics in it. It's sort of like Woodstock for nerds. It was absolutely massive. I've never been to such a large gathering before. It had, you know, tons of panels where people were talking to creators of graphic novels, comics, TV shows, movies, everything from sci-fi to fantasy to superheroes. And it had an exhibitor's floor where lots of people were, you know, selling their wares, not just comics, and giving out lots of swag. And it was really, really cool.
So considering the nature of the show, I just have to ask, were people selling crystals that would give you superpowers? Or
No, actually. Everyone was selling, you know, stuff that was clearly marked as this is fake or this is a replica.
And the connection between science fiction and science reality is actually pretty strong at these conventions, isn't it?
Yeah, there's, actually, depending on how you look at it, there are actually Tor Books, which is a big publisher of fantasy and sci-fi novels, and actually I think Bayon Books, they both had booths at Comic-Con in the exhibitors floor, and they had some authors and publishers and people that were working for the companies there talking about sci-fi books, and it was really cool. And actually, they had a panel there that I think IO9 put on about how people do research for sci-fi and how they take existing scientific studies and sort of speculate on what might happen in the future with it, which was pretty cool.
That is one of the trends I've heard that's become quite popular now, at least in movie industry and all that, is to go back to the real science and try and bring as much real science into it, as opposed to something in the 50s where you got an Asimov who just makes it up the...
Yeah, no, actually, there is an organization now that specifically exists to liaise between scientists and actors and television and movie producers. It's got a board of directors that has, you know, actual real scientists on it, as well as actors who are interested in keeping the science correct. And I think it's a good step towards accuracy in our media.
Well, we do know that television shows can have a surprising influence on the way people think. I mean, the X-Files craze really skyrocketed conspiracy theories, UFOs, and all kinds of paranormal beliefs. It'd be great if we had a show about skeptics. Maybe not as interesting, but be pretty cool, I think.
Well, it'd certainly be better than Ghost Hunters on sci-fi.
Or like the five other ghost hunting shows that exist.
Or the UFO hunting shows that also exist.
Or the Bigfoot hunting ones. Or the fox hunting ones. Although I don't mind the fox hunting, because it's actually grounded in reality, although it is perhaps morally reprehensible.
But yeah, actually, a UFO conference is going on, I think, this weekend or the next. I saw advertisements for it when I was in San Francisco. We took a detour from Davis to San Francisco one day. But yeah. There was a lot of that sort of thing at Comic-Con. And actually, they had a couple of companies were launching their products and promoting them by blurring the lines between reality and fiction. There was actually, I don't know if you watched Eureka, but there's a cafe in that show called Cafe Diem. And actually, outside of the conference center, just down the road, Sci-Fi, their booth was actually a converted cafe that they turned into the real live Cafe Diem.
That'd be cool. I like Eureka.
Which was very cool. And a couple of other people, there was Tron was promoting their new movie, Tron Legacy, via you could actually go into Flynn's arcade and play the games that exist in the movie there. And actually, just the week before Comic-Con, I was at a conference about these alternate reality games, and there was a panel there about blurring the lines between reality and fiction. And a couple of things that came up there were how to decide whether something is real on the internet. And this one guy, they basically created a completely fictional character, and it wasn't difficult at all to convince people that he was real. Just based on, like, you know, he set up a Twitter account, he set up a Flickr account, he set up an account on a forum, and that was it. Everyone thought he was real because they checked one thing and, you know, they weren't sure, well, are you real? This is a community of people that normally play alternate reality games, so they tend to be skeptical of whether a person is real or not. But all it takes to convince someone that you are an actual factual person is to have just a couple of accounts in multiple places and refer to them over the course of, I think he existed only for 2 or 3 months.
Actually, but I think that also points to one of the problems you have, not so much with your community that you were talking about, but when you get blinders on. I mean, obviously, this was a digital person. So if you went out and you went to this guy's home, well, there was no home to go to. Or if you went to talk to him, unless, of course, the person was lying, which I admit would add another dimension to it. But, I mean, if all you're looking for to see whether he's real is, does he have a Twitter account, does he have an email account, does he have a web page, well, all those things are focused on one type of knowing, digital knowing, versus other types of knowing, high school records.
Yeah, I think the point here was that when you really want to determine the accuracy of some piece of information, you got to dig way deeper than the surface.
Well, it does perhaps give us pause that the first thing we think of to clarify someone's existence is if they have Twitter. I don't Twitter, but I'm pretty sure I exist. I mean, no. I think.
No, I some people say I'm a twit, but that's not the same thing, right?
I don't know. I get that a lot, too.
Well, as long as the I doesn't get changed to an A, I think you're fine.
But no, well, but you come up with a very interesting thing, and one of the things that goes with your blurring between reality and fiction, although I wouldn't say it's really blurring between reality and fiction, it's a change in the paradigm. The idea that my parents are not that digitally aware. I mean, they're far more than a lot of people
well,
of their age.
They don't exist.
Well, no, but that's the whole point. I mean, today's generation, and more so with each current generation, is becoming more and more integrated with the World Wide Web, with
globalization,
right? Wireless technology. You know, Rob always has his little cell phone on, and he's telling us about all the wonderful peaches he's had in the world and stuff like that. And if you told that to my grandmother, she'd say, "Well, who the heck would want to know?" But then you talk to people today, and that's just part of the cultural norm, and how there is a shifting, a migration of part of our identity from what I termed before as a physical reality to an alternative or digital reality.
Well, you know, it's funny because a lot of sociologists often speak of feeling isolated, even in big cities. All this globalization makes us feel very small. So all this Twittering and blogging and other stuff that people do is a way to sort of constantly remind people, yes, I do exist because people follow me on my tweets. So.
Well, exactly. And I mean, you know, my friends when I was growing up in high school were the people in my neighborhood. But now my friends, although I don't have a lot yet, but they are all across the world. I mean, I have some in London. I have some in Japan. I have some across Canada, right? So, I mean, you know, in one sense, you know, my physical presence hasn't changed. But because of this advent of a digital personality,
you can get connected with people further and far afield.
Assuming they're real people.
Well, when I went down to Comic-Con, I actually met up with a couple of people that I had known online through contacting them, you know, in alternate reality gaming context. And I met them in reality, and they were quite fine people. And actually, on my previous trip earlier this year, I actually stayed with a couple of these people, you know.
No, so I agree. And I mean, you know, I mean, a lot of things become quite blurred, too, because I remember one case I read about last year about a couple who got a divorce because his avatar was playing with someone else's avatar on one of these, I forget which
probably Second Life.
I think it was Second Life and all that, right? And not only was that funny or unusual,
funny.
But it also became a meta controversy because everyone was reporting about how silly it was that these people were talking about this real, end quotes, finger quotes, problem they're having. But again, it's just a shift in reality. But of course, I'd be quite curious to know what people out there think about this whole idea of what is real in a digital age.
Yeah, do send us your comments to radio.freethinker@gmail.com.
That's right. And, well, Don, we've been talking about Comic-Con, but what happened in history today?
Oh, what didn't happen in history? In fact, I could quite honestly say
didn't happen in history.
That everything except for the now and the future happened in history.
That is fascinating.
Wow. Actually, you know, it's funny talking about how technology changes things or whatever, because this day in history, in 1939, Albert Einstein and Leo Szilard wrote a letter to Roosevelt saying, "We need to work on a nuclear bomb. If we don't get the bomb, the Nazis will, and that will be bad for everything." And here was a future idea, nuclear bomb, metal that blows up in such a big thing. And yet, also this week in history, 1945, the little boy bomb was dropped, and it became a reality. So you had, in a space of 5 years, 6 years, something that was beyond the concept of the people of the time becoming a reality. And anyone who's lived post-1945, which I assume will be the majority of our listeners. The idea, the threat of nuclear weapons. I mean, when I was growing up, it was the Soviet Union and the United States was going to do it. Nowadays, we have threats from terrorists, or even some people are worried about North Korea, which honestly isn't a threat to me. But if I was South Korean, I might be a bit more nervous, you know.
Well, actually, too, it's a really fascinating history, the course of the atomic project, or the Manhattan Project, I should say, actually had unlimited government funding while it was being researched. They considered that's more than the Apollo missions ever had. Quite a remarkable feat.
I think it also points to the idea that a lot of people say, well, we can't do this, especially in the United States right now. They're talking about healthcare and how they can't afford it. But if something is important enough, human race has always managed to buckle down and pretty much always get it done. And when it hasn't got it done, I guess it wasn't that important.
Yeah.
And we're not just rambling here. All of these concepts of determining whether something is factually true, government funding, the distinction of what happens when you have a digital era, all of these things are going to come back when we talk about our special segment later on in the show.
Boom, 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 boom.
So I think we should go to maybe a break right now.
Commercial break sounds pretty good. Let's do that.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Welcome back on Radio Free Thinker, our hour-long special.
Because of the hour-long special, we have an extended This Day in History. In fact, this particular one I like especially for a particular reason. First of all, I'll tell you what it is. In 1977, the United States Senate began hearings into MKUltra. MKUltra is a real conspiracy. Now, of course, we always have to distinguish. There's lots of conspiracies out there that are fake, like the moon landing being a fake. Kennedy being shot by the Martians, which I think is fake, although someone shot him. But
he wasn't shot by Martians, it was Venusians.
But MKUltra, for those who probably don't know, was a CIA program to basically figure out how to brainwash, how to reprogram people. It came out in the 60s, which was a time if anyone's watched The Manchurian Candidate, either the original or the remake. Original's much better.
Was it The Queen of Diamonds?
Something like that. And the idea was to take new chemicals like LSD, electroshock therapy, among other things, and literally wipe the mind clean and reprogram it. Now, this program was done by the CIA, but it has a very interesting connection to Canada, because there is a doctor in Montreal named Donald Ewan Cameron, who was a leading person in this field. And he was...
In mind wiping and reprogramming?
In mind wiping.
Because it sounds like an episode of Dollhouse.
Well, and the technical term he used was psychic driving. The idea, again, were...
Sounds terrifying.
Well, it is. I mean, in addition to LSD, he would put people through shock therapies, repetitive shock therapies, that were 30 to 40% stronger than what they would normally give. Shock therapy is a valid therapy. It's good to use for some people. But he would crank up the dose and increase the number of times and try and induce comas. People would go into comas for up to 3 months. While they were in comas, they had the little tape in the background saying, "You will kill communists. You will kill communists," or something, that to try and reprogram these people. Now, this guy did it in Montreal. They also did the experiment throughout the United States. What makes it conspiracy things, a lot of the people who were involved in this program didn't know they were involved in this program. I remember seeing a documentary in the CBC, I think it was in the 90s, could have been the 80s, about this woman who went in there. She was suffering from mild depression, very mild depression. This doctor got a hold of her, and she's lost decades of her life. Literally, they've been erased from her brain by this thing. She never consented. It was all done essentially against her will. The family, of course, this is back in the 60s or whenever, when everyone respected doctors. Doctors weren't in it for the money. They were people to be honored. And it was totally things. Now,
creepy.
It was. Well, you know, next time you get your pills from your doctor, I don't know. Where this enters into the sphere of conspiracy is in 73, the CIA director, Richard Helms, ordered that all the documents, all the CIA documents related to this, were being destroyed. And the vast majority of the documents were destroyed. Fortunately, some of them managed to slip through the net. Fortunately, because of people who actually lived through it, the CIA isn't like perhaps the Nazis who would have gone out and eliminated everyone involved in the program. Word had leaked out, and there was eventually this investigation into it, and eventually the connection to Canada came out, and it came up. The thing I like about it, again, is the idea is that, you know, there are real conspiracies out there. They do happen. But one of the great things I find about them is, one, they're reasonable conspiracies, and people can't, humans in general, can't hold a secret. I mean, we're really
bad at keeping our mouths shut.
Exactly. Here was a purposeful attempt to try and cover up something, and they still screwed it up. Right. Although, of course, some people have used this to make it an irrational argument, perhaps.
A leap.
Well, a guy named Lawrence Teeter is an attorney who is convinced that Sirhan Sirhan, who shot Robert F. Kennedy, who was a big person, he was going to be probably the next president of the United States instead of Nixon, boo, that he was actually programmed by the CIA program, the CIA project to kill him. So, MK Ultra, real conspiracies do exist. Beware. Trust no. Well, okay, you can trust us.
Well, no, don't trust us. Check all our facts, and if you have any concerns with it, email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com.
Right. Well, they can check out this new story. I hate to disappoint our listeners, but Wafergate has come to a close.
Oh my goodness.
So a few weeks ago, we commented on a story about the Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, supposedly pocketing a communion wafer at a Catholic funeral. Well, big surprise, Harper has received an apology from the New Brunswick newspaper that suggested he pocketed this supposed wafer. At the time, we kind of thought this was a funny story, considering this is supposed to be a secular nation, and no one religion is supposed to find its way into politics. When this was initially reported, Catholics were angry that Harper didn't eat the wafer, Protestants were happy that he didn't eat the wafer, Harper is after all Protestant, and it created a minor media storm. A funny storm, but a storm nonetheless. So the newspaper has apologized. They've actually fired two people who were involved in the story. Unfortunately, they didn't apologize for wasting front-page stuff to frivolous mumbo-jumbo.
We apologize for wasting a few minutes to talk about the story every time.
We are now part of this stupid thing. It's ridiculous, but...
Well, we were talking before the show. I mean, there's always like two or three levels to a conspiracy. To these type of things, you have the controversy.
Memes.
Then you have the meta-controversy, which is people talking about the controversy. I mean, the same thing happened with Michael Jackson. Everyone's sitting there, first of all, saying, ooh, Michael Jackson died. Was he murdered? Ooh. And then everyone said, my God, why is everyone talking about Michael Jackson? And then that became a big thing. And yes, Wafergate. Although I did hear actually that the paper retracted that because apparently Harper was struck by lightning. Apparently God said, no, you weren't. No, I made that up. Sorry.
Well.
Check that fact, especially.
Yeah. This is why we urge skepticism upon of our listeners. Well, again.
Because we're friggin' liars.
Well, and actually, let's go. One of the things, I don't know if we reported it, but I know some people reported about Michael Jackson being murdered. And as it turned out...
There is actually a lot of people investigating on that. Like, it's just saying that his doctor gave him the wrong kinds of injections.
Well, for the research I did, and I know... I am so embarrassed to say that I've done research on this, but the research
spent
I've done
hours
on this...
sitting in front of Google typing in MJ murdered.
Well, I have some friends who actually like Michael Jackson, and they actually bring this up. I have talked to them afterwards, and apparently the point was is that he shopped around for a doctor who would give him this particular type of anesthetic, which every doctor says, no, we're not going to give it to you because you're going to die if you take it. But Michael Jackson, I guess, suffered from insomnia and was desperate, and if you got money... Shit happens. Now, the big investigation is he was a doctor. He was allowed to do this, but everyone said it was immoral for him to do this, yada, yada. But anyhow, again, there are real conspiracies and fake conspiracies.
Yeah, people look at news stories, and it seems the more ridiculous and frivolous they are, the more airtime they take, because the more people talk about how frivolous and ridiculous they are.
You know, if there's only something we could do to help stem the tide of I don't know, this woo-woo type stuff. We talked last week about that convention that was in Vancouver. Ethan, do we come up with any ideas of what we might do to try and...
Well, that's really funny that you mentioned that, Don.
It's but not funny actually, at all. They planned this ahead of time.
We got an email from our friends at CFI, and it turns out they were actually thinking the same thing. They want to get a booth there as well. And they realize that it's expensive, and they have a few ideas, perhaps a Dunk the Skeptic tank. But
actually, I think the best idea is if we sell homeopathic ration medicine, reason medicine, that if you take this homeopathic stuff, and it will give you reason rationality.
We could sell homeopathic water, and then we could advertise it, you know, honestly. This has all the effects of real water.
That's not a bad idea. Well, to our listeners, if you have any suggestions or you generally want to contribute, whether it's a fundraiser or donations or whatever, you know, let us know. Email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com or contact CFI. And hopefully the skeptics organizations of BC can come together. Maybe we can get something done here because this is an important issue.
Actually, yeah, I think I would encourage anyone to send to our email.
I just radio.freethinker@gmail.com.
And again, you know, if you want to send us, if you want to pledge to send us $5 or $10, right, please do. If you have ideas for that, please do that. I would like this show to be the focus for this movement to try and get a table at this thing. I mean, we will do it in conjunction with all the skeptic groups in Vancouver, but we have a voice being Vancouver's only skeptic radio show.
So far as we know.
Yeah, unless there's another one.
You're not skeptic about that, are you?
If there are, they should let us know, too. Well, why don't we take a quick commercial break, and we'll come back, and we'll be talking a bit about H1N1 vaccines.
You're listening to
CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
Ice cream man, can I have this? I want this over here, and a toast on by my father, and give me this ice over here, and vanilla cone. Thank you, ice cream man. Thank you, ice cream man.
Okay, we're back. And so, the swine flu, H1N1, Mexican flu, whatever you want to call it, is out there.
A waste of time.
It's out there, and it's scaring people. And what can we do about that?
No, it's not scaring people so much anymore because the media has completely lost interest.
Well, have they? Because I've been reading a lot of articles about this, and it's coming up over and over again. This particular article that I'm talking about here was done through Reuters. I mean, it's out there. People generally don't know what they're talking about, unfortunately. I think it's a sad state of affairs with journalism. I just want to point this out, though. This is a fact. H1N1 has infected about 800 people worldwide. That's a moderate category pandemic by the WHO, not the band, the World Health Organization.
Did all those 800 die?
That's what I have here. So 800 out of, what is it, 9 billion people or something?
Well, yeah, and I don't think...
6 billion.
6 billion, close enough.
The death toll, too, I think, from it is very restricted, but I mean, maybe 100, 150 worldwide, again, who've died.
Yeah, there's enough infected that it's a worldwide...
Keeping in mind that the regular flu influenza is going to kill more people in the United States alone.
Yep.
Well, swine flu has done so far.
And from what I understand, I mean, more by a lot, like 500,000 people in the United States die every year.
Yeah.
Granted, most of those are seniors, but I mean...
Well, I want to talk about some of these fears that have been raised recently, specifically about the vaccine. And as everyone knows, I have a thing about vaccines. So some common fears that have been raised, I'm really irritated to see, is one of the big ones is mercury and neurological disorders. There is no connection. The risk of thimerosal, which is what the mercury is, and people often mistake that twice, and I'll explain that in a second, that has been debunked many times. There is absolutely no evidence, absolutely none, of a link between neurological disorders and thimerosal, a.k.a. mercury. I would be surprised.
So the Mad Hatter is a myth?
Well, no, actually, there's something I think we should use the term mercury. But, I mean, it's important to remember that mercury is not just mercury. It's the same thing. It's like carbon, right? You have carbon as in soot, or carbon as in graphite, carbon as in diamond. The way the mercury is, and it's a particular molecule of mercury that's in this, which is a non-absorbing type.
I mean, exactly.
It's not like the mercury you get from mercury poisoning. This is a different form of it, in the same way carbon, graphite versus diamond is a different form.
That's a good point. Thimerosal is is a compound that has ethyl mercury in it. Now, ethyl mercury is the less harmful kind. Less harmful than methyl mercury, which you will get in breast milk. So keep that in mind. Remember, it was removed from vaccines about 7 years ago anyway, so there shouldn't be any thimerosal in vaccines, even if it was harmful, which it's not. So people often say, okay, well, what about adverse reactions to the seasonal flu vaccine? I don't understand what that means. What adverse reactions are we talking about?
If you get, where are you getting these quotes and concerns from?
Well, see, this came from an article in Reuters enlisting a big conference that they had about all these concerns that the vaccine, because it's being rushed into production.
It's important to clarify that the Reuters news agency is sort of, a meta news agency. It's the thing from which all the other newspapers tend to get that, along with AP.
That's why I'm kind of concerned about this, because it's... Anyway, the notion that you can get sick from the regular flu vaccine, it's a possibility, but generally speaking, it's because you already had the flu when you got the vaccine. The vaccine is designed to provoke a response in your immune system. So you might get the response and go, oh, I'm getting the flu, but you get better in a few days, as opposed to getting the flu and getting sick for like 2 weeks.
Well, also, too, there's the whole idea of statistics here, right? I mean, no flu vaccine is 100%. Right? So you might get anywhere from 5 to 10% of the people who get the actual vaccination. It doesn't actually take. So you actually do get a number of people who've had the vaccination who may get sick from it. But I mean, it's like you say, 5 or 10% versus those who don't get it, where you're getting close to, 100% could in theory be infected by it because they have no protection at all.
Well, it gets back to herd immunity, which is why we want to get a certain level of people vaccinated who can protect those who either can't be vaccinated or those who choose not to because they are afraid for some reason. Now, they also mention a few other kind of points here that I want to address. One is there are special additives called adjuvants which cause reactions. Now, these adjuvants, they're not dangerous. They're supposed to be in the vaccine. They're what stimulate the immune system. And that's how vaccines work. They're supposed to do that.
Yeah, I get the sense that a lot of people don't really understand how vaccinations work.
That's a good point. So vaccinations, don't you get it and there's like some invisible force field that prevents the germ from getting into you? Isn't that how they work?
Well, see, there are different kinds, right? The standard flu vaccine comes in two forms. There's the live one, which is usually in the form of a nasal spray. Then there's the dead version, which is injected. And both of them work very well. They're both very safe. You're probably not going to die. The only reason that people do get sick is in the original H1N1 vaccines, which were back in, I believe, the 70s, was that the vaccine caused a reaction, which proved to be fatal. But it was a known quantity. We know now what caused it, and we know how to stop it this time. It was a very rare situation. It's not even a disease. It's a bad reaction that your immune system has. But to say that it's going to happen again is misrepresenting the facts. The scientists realized what went wrong. They fixed the situation. It's not going to happen again.
Now, of course, I think maybe a little more research on my part would have helped me in this. But so you're sitting there saying that in the past, scientists were wrong, and they could be wrong in the future.
Yeah, scientists are not gods.
Oh.
Which is, one of those things that's fortunately, I guess. But yes, science can be wrong in the past.
So
doesn't mean it's always wrong or will be wrong in the future.
The point is that we, are trying to make things better and fix our mistakes as opposed to keeping the old errors and not changing them ever.
Exactly.
And again, I think going back to the idea that even if there is a chance that they might make another mistake, the odds of that happening are so much more insignificant because we have learned from it. But you still haven't explained exactly how does vaccination protect you.
Okay, so a vaccine, when you get it either injected or administered another way, it's designed to provoke a response. And the goal here is to get your antigens to recognize the invading force. And this is a natural process. Anytime something foreign enters your body, your immune system is activated. That's why some people reject organ transplants. The goal here is to produce memory cells, which memorize basically the blueprints, quote-unquote, of the virus.
The structure.
Exactly. So when you're infected again, you don't need to spend like 2 weeks building up the immunity to fight the disease.
You already have immune cells and antigens that recognize the shape of the invading virus and can immediately deal with it.
Exactly. And that's part of the problem is that people mistake the fact that, oh, I got the flu vaccine and then I get sick. But you're not realizing that you're going to get sick, but it takes a few days for your body to fight off the infection, as opposed to, without the vaccine, getting sick for like 2 weeks.
Well, and actually, I think you did a little misnomer. You're not actually fighting over the infection. You're fighting over a fake infection that's designed to trick the body into thinking it's infected. Because,
yeah.
Because as you point out, that the way these are administered, you don't actually get... There actually isn't an invading force in your body, if I can use a military metaphor. Because the thing that kills you in the other times is you get this invading force, and before your body has the opportunity to ramp up its defenses, it has taken over too much and you possibly die from it. This gives you a fake infection or a pseudo thing. Your body goes through the process as if it was fighting it off, so that when you are infected with the real disease, you already have troops on the beaches to ward off the invading virons.
Overextend the metaphor a little.
Yeah. Well, again, and this is stuff that we know we take for granted, because what this article shows is there is so much misinformation about there, and it's perpetuated by people like Jenny McCarthy and David Kirby and, you know, Jim Carrey.
And even Reuters.
Apparently, yeah. And, okay, and, you know, maybe I'm giving, you know, them a hard time. Their journalists are doing what they're trained to do, which is present both sides of an issue. But as Phil Plait pointed out on our show, science doesn't have two issues. There's no left-right. It's right or wrong. And in this case, you're either right or you're wrong about vaccines. And, you know, unfortunately, this article gets a lot of facts wrong, and it presents them as though there's a medical controversy. But it's a manufactured controversy. There is no controversy among scientists.
So when you see this article, you know, check the source, see if it's from Reuters, and be wary of what the news agencies are telling you about medical issues.
Exactly. And, you know, consult reputable sources like Quackwatch or Science-Based Medicine, because, and get expert opinions here. You know, obviously I'm not an expert on vaccines, even though I like to play one on TV. But
or on the radio, rather.
Well, yeah, I have a show too.
So, sorry, just to wrap up this and actually going with the thing about our WaferGate. So one of the things about modern media and routers is it wants people to read. It likes controversy because it knows. I was going to suggest that people should write into their newspapers just to let them know, hey, we don't like this. But then that would let them know that they're actually reaching people and might promote more of this quackery.
Well, in some sense, yes. But if you think you notice a problem with news reporting, it is good to write in just to let them know that, you know, I know what you're reporting is bad science. Just like if they reported a inaccurate news story like WaferGate, people can lose their jobs. And their journalists, part of their job description is to get the facts right. And when they present material that is clearly not part of the scientific canon, it's going to confuse people. And it's one of the big problems, especially what we've been talking about with globalization and the proliferation of information, is that you cannot always tell what information is valid and what isn't.
And you could even hit them where it's important. You can threaten to say, listen, you know, I used to watch global news, but I'm not going to watch global news because you have this report. I'm just going to read The Sun. Oh, wait a minute. The Sun's owned by the same company. Well, I'm going to read The Province. Oh, no. The Province is also owned by the same 24. Well,
we should talk about monopolies of news reporting at a different time.
Well, you know, that just leads to a very important issue about who owns what and, you know, what rights they have to that. I mean, in a market like ours, the idea of who has copyrighted material is very, very interesting because it's all owned more or less by one company.
Yeah, indeed. You know, the Associated Press, AP, has recently announced that they're going to wrap their news stories in what they called, and I have quotation marks around this, a container, a wrapper, that will basically keep very hard iron grip on the rights of who gets to reprint their news stories, is how they say it. And when we come back, we're going to talk more about this issue.
Do you like wine and cheese? Get ready for Vino Camp and Cheese Camp 2009. The perfect pairing of tastes for your palate. This is definitely not a wine festival, but rather an afternoon of cheese, people, and technology in order to make wine and cheese accessible, educational, and fun.
Join us Saturday, August 8th from 12 to 6 p.m. at the Grad Student Society Center at UBC. Vino Camp features speakers from local and international wineries and kitchens. For tickets and information, visit vinocamp.com.
Okay, we're back. So, Rob, tell us a bit about copyright.
So, as I was just saying before the break, Associated Press has just announced this DRM wrapper for the news stories. And the way it works is basically they have a bunch of lawyers that will go around scouring the internet for people who are illegally copying, plagiarizing, some might say, their information, their news stories. And they will be charging people, I think it was $2.50 per word reprinted, sort of keeping an iron grip with their copyright.
Which I think this is really disturbing, especially for something like AP. I mean, if they had an article about how Harper was murdered the Governor General, or Harper has been ripping off the Canadian public, we couldn't report on that because that would be part of the copyright. And if we did report on it, then we might be sued by them. And from what I understand in a recent legal case, even if you don't pay up front, the back end can be even more horrific.
That's quite true. And just to go back to the beginning of these copyright issues getting more prominence in Canada, especially about 2 months ago, the Conference Board of Canada, they published a report some time ago on the state of copyright infringement and its effects on Canadian business and the businesses that own copyright, the copyright holders, and basically say that you know the usual pap about, oh, it's bad, it hurts the companies, it hurts the country, etc. Now, 2 months ago, they and I'm quoting here from an article by Cory Doctorow from Boing Boing. The Conference Board is a supposedly neutral research outfit that has asked by the Canadian copyright industries to write a report on file sharing and piracy in Canada. They hit up the Ontario government for $15,000 to fund an event where the findings of the report would be presented. Then they hired an independent researcher who concluded that there wasn't anything particularly wrong with Canadian file sharing. They threw away his research. Then they plagiarized dodgy press materials produced by leading U.S. copyright lobby groups, quoting lengthy passages that turned out to be factually wrong. Then they denied any wrongdoing. Then they admitted they plagiarized, but insisted that the public money hadn't been spent on the report. It had been spent on the conference about the report, which is a different thing altogether, in all capitals. So this news story broke, and suddenly people all over Canada were buzzing about copyright issues and whether it was actually copyright infringement and piracy were harmful. And so flash forward a couple months, and now Canada is having a nationwide consultation. They've set up a website, and they have town hall meetings in various cities all over Canada where they ask the public what they think about copyright and how copyright reform should go ahead.
I might point out that I visited their website, and you'll find the link on our blog, and it's actually, I'm quite impressed with the website. I'm a little nervous that the government, having trying to sort of slip something in last fall with the law, will actually listen to what's going on there, but the actual process itself seems to be quite admirable.
So as it stands right now, these new ideas are going to be used to create new copyright laws in Canada.
As far as I know, yes.
So currently, right now, with our existing laws, is it illegal for me to, say, download a movie on my computer without paying for it?
I believe so, yes. That's what the companies have us believe. And it's sort of, I'm not actually sure about the actual wording of copyright law.
What if I downloaded something that was made, I don't know, say, 72 years ago, a really old film?
Well, the from what I understand, the current copyright law is in effect for the life of the artist plus 50 years. So if you downloaded 1984, right, which was written not quite 100 years ago, but 75 years ago, thereabouts.
Some time ago. It's in the public domain.
Right. Well, because it's British. And British has actually a very different law than ours do. But the point is it would still, I think it still would be covered because George
or
Orwell
is it in the public domain?
George Orwell died in the 70s, I believe. And it's not been 50 years since he died. So by Canadian law, it would still be under copyright. So you'd be...
So who owns that copyright? Does his descendants own it?
Well, actually, that leads to a very interesting thing. Technically, it goes on to his estate. Ergo, what's the plus 50 years? Or whoever owns the rights to it. Which leads into some really weird things, because you get something like a Happy Birthday. This was a big thing. Happy Birthday was written by a couple of people, I think, in the 30s or 40s. And it was everywhere, because the people who wrote it died, and the rights sort of went into the ether. But Sony, or one of the other big companies, bought the rights and suddenly started enforcing it, which is why you hardly ever hear Happy Birthday now, and that, 'cause it costs so much money to legalize these things. It also came up recently with Google Books. Google Books has been digitizing all sorts of material, books, and a lot of the copyrights on those are either expired, or as you point out, they don't know who owns the rights right now. They're either people who have died or have fallen off the face of the earth. And actually, ironically enough, because of a recent court ruling or agreement, I think with the ACTRA or some of the media groups, that they actually now effectively have a new copyright on all of that material that they have digitized.
So it's very ambivalent right now who owns what. And I guess the issue we're getting at here is that our copyright laws are very, very vague, and it makes it very difficult to understand what exactly is public domain and what is not, what is off limits for the sharing of ideas.
Now, basically, to hash out what actually copyrights law enables people to do, it goes to court. So the RIAA, their army of lawyers, they take people to court based on infringement copyright laws, and it's left up to, you know, them, the jury and the judge, to figure out what to do in these cases, because now that the internet exists and people are able to download basically copies of things without actually changing them or anything like that, that no one really knows how copyright law applies to this idea. And so one of the most famous trials, the RIAA versus Joel Tannenbaum. Joel Tannenbaum was a graduate student in Boston, and he downloaded 30 songs, I believe, via LimeWire or Kazaa or some sort of sharing service like that. And this has been a very long-running trial, and he got an army of copyright lawyers, and RIAA has their own. And it finally came to an end just a couple days ago. And basically, Tannenbaum has to pay $675,000 for 30 songs that he downloaded to four record labels. And none of the artists are getting any of the money for the songs that they...
Correct me if I'm wrong, but that number seems a lot more than if I went to a record store and bought them.
That is a massively... massively larger number than just paying for the 30 songs.
So where do we draw the line here? Now, supposedly someone bought these CDs, put them on their computer, and is quote-unquote sharing them with somebody. If I bought a CD and you guys came over and listened to it, when does that cross the line from just us hanging around to copyright violation?
Well, there's actually two issues in here. One is a very technical one, which deals with what they call DMR, which Rob had mentioned
DRM,
earlier. DRM, thank you. Digital Rights Management, which essentially is the electronic lock on it. So anyone who's used iTunes stuff type that, getting anything off of iTunes can be quite a pain, especially if you bought it from the iTunes store, because it has very restrictive digital rights. So even if you bought this song and you wanted to put it onto your MP3 player, you might not be able to do that. Or if you take it from one computer and try and put it onto another computer, even though you've paid for it, digital rights management prevents these type of things.
No, this actually extends even to, you mentioned 1984 earlier, and there was a big problem with 1984 as an ebook format on the Kindle put out by Amazon, which included some DRM problems on that. And what they found out was that the person that was selling the book didn't actually have the rights to sell it, and so they removed it from people's Kindles without telling them. And so there's a lawsuit going on right now over whether they had the right to do that.
So DMR is one part of it. The other part of it, which is going more to heart, is the idea of fair use. Now, copyright says, essentially, you cannot steal this material. And it implies you cannot make a profit off of someone else's work. That's sort of the underlying thing. So when you go to court, one of the things that the judge is taking into effect is this being used fair use? So if you're a student and you're doing some research into something, traditionally, you are allowed to make copies of certain materials for your research material, and that's considered to be fair use. Or if you want to copy from one machine to another, again, that can be considered to be fair use. But of course, this isn't cut and dry. There's lots of people who say, listen, what constitutes fair use isn't too, like parody. Parody is a great one. If I sit there and I make the Simpsons are famous for this, for making parodies of Disney, but they also go to great lengths to make sure that they don't actually use the word Disney in it, because they have to be careful that it is a parody and not infringing on the copyright of Disney. So fair use is kind of going with what you're saying. If you have friends over and they all listen to it, that's fair use. If you have friends over and you charge them for it, or if you are a bar owner and you buy a CD and technically you play it as a private CD but in a public place, that also infringes certain copyrights, because when you buy it, it's intended for private use, not public use.
And now when people are trying to share these sorts of things, and especially, you know, with file sharing over the internet, the sort of Byzantine structure of current copyright law, which has been sort of bodged together over the past, I don't know, 20 to 30 years, doesn't really apply anymore, because it doesn't know how to handle these sorts of things. And it's vague enough that big companies, you know, like the groups like the RIAA are using it basically to subvert, and this is my own opinion here, subvert the original idea of copyright, which is to protect the rights of the creator, the artist who created the material, the writer who wrote the piece, from having their work used by someone else against their wishes, and using it to basically bleed people out of large sums of money.
It sounds to me like these copyright laws did not take into account the internet.
They did not.
And that's the big issue here, is that we do not know how to apply these old, I don't know when these laws were written, 19th century laws, to, you know, our standards today.
Well, and actually part of the reason why the conservative government is being so eager to do this, it isn't just because of their financial backers, assuming editorial there, but is the fact that Canada signed an international agreement for the World Intellectual Property Organization. It's a treaty designed to try to globalize copyrights because, as you mentioned, World Wide Web. If I buy something in Canada, can I give it to someone who is not in Canada, because the copyright only applies to Canada? And the idea is to universalize this. But one of the things that makes this very controversial is the idea between breaking digital rights locks, DMRs, versus the technology that allows you to do it. So someone has, let's say, Napster was a famous one, but right now a lot of people will use torrents or whatever. Well, let's say I have a home movie and I use torrent to spread, hey, everyone, look, I did this funny thing and wouldn't you love to see it, or YouTube, right? So I spread it out to YouTube. The technology that I used to spread that out could also be used to spread out the new Harry Potter movie. And one of the things that some of the stakeholders in this debate want to do is they want to make it illegal not only to break the digital locks, but even to sell or provide services that could break digital rights or copyrights.
They might as well, you know, shut down the entire internet.
Well, yeah, and it also infringes on legitimate uses of this. I mean, there are lots of legitimate things. You know, if you're an independent producer and you don't have Sony behind you to distribute your music, file sharing law is a great way for people to get out there and to know. So when you go have a concert in town and you sell your T-shirts, people will show up because they know who the heck you are.
Yeah. And so far, this has all been in mostly backgrounds and opinions, but there's actually been quite a lot of studies done on the effects of DRM, of file sharing, of so-called copyright infringement, and so on. And one of the studies I have queued up on my phone here was they did a European large-scale study that found that DRM actually encourages people to pirate. When things are locked in these closed, you know, proprietary formats, locked up with DRM, not able to transfer from one thing to another, people end up pirating just because they believe that they already own the item. They just want to transfer it to another thing, perfectly, like well within the limits of what they're their fair use would be, but that the DRM prevents them from doing, possibly with no basis. And actually, it was kind of amusing because this article, you found that, I mean, it led blind people to go and download illegal copies of the Bible off of the internet. So, like, completely ridiculous things just because the amounts, that the lengths that DRM went to lock them out from doing perfectly reasonable things.
Well, that actually points out one of the stakeholders, again, the Public Interest Advocacy Center, mentions that, and it says one of the things that it wants to promote is the idea of shifting rights, time shifting, space shifting, format shifting. If you sit there and you record a movie that's on at 7 o'clock, let's say Lost, you're a fan of Lost, and you use your PVR to record Lost, and then you watch it later on because you see it at work, technically that can be considered to be an infringement of copyright. Or if you sit there and you copy it onto your desktop and you want to watch it on your iPod, again, changing format could technically cause that as a copyright. Where it gets really ridiculous is if you sit there, and this is the Canadian Association of Librarians or something like that, are pointing the idea that if you're a blind person and someone takes a book and they read it onto a tape, which happens, that technically is a copyright infringement. So it's inherently disenfranchising handicapped people who need. I mean, I for one have trouble reading. A lot of the stuff I get is audiobooks. And if someone sat there and read a book onto a cassette so that I could listen to it, they're breaking the law.
Well, again, this is a really fascinating discussion, not only because of the vagueness of the laws and the new dimensions that the laws will take in the future, but we're also talking about how we are going to transmit ideas across our new technologies. So it's a really fascinating debate. I'd be very curious to hear what some of our listeners think about this. So again, please email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com if you have any opinions or questions, comments, or criticisms.
And do make your opinions heard at the Canadian Copyright Consultation website, which I'm afraid I don't have the address for, but you can find it pretty easily.
I'm sure if they Google.
I'm actually kind of curious to, actually I know the answer to this now that I think about it, who has the copyright on the material from this this forum? But oddly enough, one of the weird factoids I discovered is that the United States government, all their publications are public domain. Australia has what they call a Creative Commons license, which is basically public domain license. Canadian publications by the Canadian government are private things. So if you take a government publication and you make a copy, let's say for your essay, you quote a bit of it or whatever, technically you're infringing copyright law. Canadian government publications are not owned by the people, they're owned by the government, and don't you dare use them.
So every time we quote statistics, we're violating copyright?
Technically,
we are in so much trouble.
Uh-oh.
Actually, going back to the Australian government uses the Creative Commons license, and the Creative Commons license, it's a set of licenses that was created as legal, enforceable rights licenses that are actually a kind of solution to the vagueness and ridiculous problems that come with copyright. And artists and creators are using Creative Commons licenses, which come in a variety of different flavors, to circumvent the weird problems that come with this. There's a license called the attribution nonprofit license, which all it says is, like, you can reprint this stuff. All you have to do is attribute me, say that where it came from me, and you're not allowed to profit from it.
Yeah.
So they're very specific licenses that you can attach to things that you create, which circumvent the vagueness of copyright law.
For those people who are interested, if you just go on the internet and you look up Creative Commons or you look at anti-copyright, both of those are movements that are designed to show you the alternative to copyright legislation.
Though not to say that some of the more Byzantine parts of copyright law don't have their benefits. The GPL, that very famous license under which things from the EFF are licensed, I think Linux might even be, most of it is licensed under GPL. That actually is based in a very complex system of loopholes and weird stuff that people have found in the copyright system of laws.
Well, again, fascinating debate, and please give us your 2 cents. Well, we're just about out of time on our very first hour-long episode, so do we have a quote to end on?
Yes, we do. This comes from the Anti-Copyright Movement website. The European Renaissance saw a burgeoning of creating talent, the like of which has not been seen since. It occurred before intellectual property had been invented and was spurred by artists copying each other's techniques and works without legal restrictions. The argument that copyright law protects and encourages creativity is seen by many to be hype intended to provide moral justification for laws, which in fact were there to protect the incomes of wealthy copyright holders, so many of whom were not even the original artists anyway.
Excellent. Well, this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying goodnight.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
This is Rob saying please go online and make your voice heard at these various websites that we've mentioned today, and let us know what you think of our hour-long show at radio.freethinker@gmail.com.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.
Big government and big pharma have entered into a secret conspiracy in which secret government contracts are sold to big pharma that allow for secret chemicals to be placed in coffee seeds, all under the watchful eye of Big Coffee, who is secretly working with other world forces, all in a sinister plot to get alien embryos in our coffee so big pharma can sell us alien contraceptive pills. Or, if you'd rather get some rational news, check out Radio Free Thinker, the radio show / podcast that promotes skepticism, critical thinking, and science education, every Tuesdays at 4 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Beautiful country. You know, I rode out here about 50 years ago on a little dun horse and started a film career. Picture called The Big Trail. Well, I made quite a few since then. Some good and some bad. Matter of fact, in those days...
CITR!
Matter of fact, they come in pretty handy anytime. It's kind of nice to know you have something set aside. So if you ever figure on that, remember that
CITR
can be mighty helpful.
Yeah!